We are Sarva. The future of education starts here.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Everyday Genius, a publication by Simply Conscious. I'm your host for today's episode, Pete Craig. And it's my pleasure to welcome to the show today someone who's been at the forefront of like relationship transformation, body-mind therapies for the last 40 years. It may be more now, and I'm sure he'll correct us once we dive in. He's, along with his wife, he's been best-selling. He's been an author of over 35 books and best-selling author of many, including perhaps one of the best-known, or from my perspective, the best-known, which is The Big Leap. And I've just finished reading that, or just finished listening to that on audio. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome Gay Hendricks to today's show. Gay, welcome.
Thank you very much, Pete. I'm really happy to be here with you today. We're talking about all of my favorite subjects.
Absolutely. You know what? It's funny because we re-engaged with the project Simply Conscious after 4 years. It's something we launched 4 years ago and then paused. And we re-engaged with it only probably 8 weeks ago. And one of the, without even like looking at anyone else's work, we had this idea that what we wanted to do was help people to reconnect with their inner wisdom and ignite their own genius. And looking at ways that this could happen. And then one of my business partners said to me, he said, I'm reading this book. He said, it's called The Big Leap. He said, I really think you should listen to it as well. So started listening to it. And then I came across your second book, The Joy of Genius, and it just seemed so perfect that actually, you should be someone that we reach out to, because you seem to have studied this area, for so long now. There's definitely some insights I'm sure we can glean from this. But before we dive in, I just wanted to kind of do something that we tend to do as a group, as a company, which is invite you just to share, what's alive in you right now.
Well, at this very moment, let me start with the basics. I feel a shimmering glow of alive, buzzy energy in my body, which I would interpret as excitement and joy. And I'm living my genius at this moment. I decided that my genius, way back, way before I wrote The Big Leap, my genius was to expand in love, creativity, and abundance every day as I inspire other people to do the same. And so I turned my life into a living laboratory of how much love and abundance and creativity I could welcome into my life, and also dedicated my life to inspiring other people to do that. So I was trying to do the math in my head. I saw my first client in 1968. So what would that be? Is that 52 years ago? That's scary. Long time ago.
52, yeah. It's two years before I was born.
Well, 2 years before you were born, I was sitting in a chair in New Hampshire, in snowy New Hampshire, where I was a teacher and sort of counselor wrangler for 105 delinquent boys. And there was six teachers and a couple of administrators. And we each had a group of about 20 delinquent kids that we were working with all the time. So it was a kind of a combination school and treatment center. But one of the kids had a terrible fear of snakes. And at the time I was getting my graduate degree, my master's degree, and there had been a lot of research on snake phobia. And this kid was interesting because he'd never actually seen a snake in real life. He'd grown up in inner city Boston and never actually witnessed a snake. But he was so scared of snakes that his mother had to go through magazines before he would leaf through them and tear out any pages that had to do with snakes. So I saw that kid for the first time. He was my first client. And I'll always remember him because he was this big 6'4" black kid who played star basketball on our basketball team. And yet he had this fear of snakes. It was such an incongruous kind of thing. So anyway, that was my first client before you were born.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. Well, it's just testament to, the depth of knowledge that you have in this area, that you've been studying this same thing for so long. And that's quite rare, to find people, especially in this day and age, that follow one path, for such a long time. We tend, as as humans these days to kind of jump about from one thing to the next. What's your observation of that? You know, why do you think that is?
Well, it's because I think I made a dedicated commitment to furthering my genius way back, long before I wrote about it in The Big Leap. We're talking about around 1990 or something like that. So perhaps 30 to 35 years ago, I made a real commitment, a whole body commitment to live in my genius as much as I possibly could. And at the time, I assessed that I was living in my genius about 10% of the time. And when I realized that, it shook me to my bones, you know, because I realized, wait, I'm on this planet for a very short period of time, and I'm living in my zone of excellence, but I'm not living in my genius, what I now call the genius spiral. I wasn't on the spiral yet. And so I kind of rolled the clock forward, and I thought, well, I'm a professor at a university, and I'm going to be teaching this for the next 30 years until I retire. Is this what I could possibly do? And every alarm cell in my body went off. No, clang, 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 do not go there. And so fortunately at that time, my wife and I had been working with couples in our living room, basically. We were both psychologists, and we'd been working with 6, 8, 10 couples at a time. And we developed a whole way of working with couples that was really producing some amazing results. And one night in front of the fireplace, at about this time, I was beginning to dedicate myself more to my genius. Katie and I had a conversation that we said, you know, what we're doing here, we really need to take this out to a larger audience. We need to write a book about it or make a TV show about it or something like that. And so I sat down and I wrote the proposal for our book, Conscious Loving. And it took me all weekend to do it. But I came out with this 25-page proposal, and I sent it off to my agent, who then marketed it to a publisher who just snapped it up right away. And for more of an advance that I had ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And so I was immediately rewarded for stepping into my genius. And then we got another, what I now call a wink from the universe, where you're kind of the universe is letting you know that you're on the right path. After Conscious Loving came out and had been out for about a year, it came out during the Persian Gulf War, so it was not easy to get on television with it, and they were doing shows about the war, obviously, and not about self-help books. So it didn't get a lot of press when it came out, but it was still a moderate bestseller. But then when it came out in paperback, we were on Oprah with it, and that took us instead of it took us to talking to 10 million people rather than people in our living room. And so then after that, I was so rewarded so well for so many years about making decisions in the direction of my genius that I decided I had to sit down and write a book about that. And as I worked with other clients with it, the model became really clear that what we needed to do first was make a commitment to bringing forth our genius, even if we didn't know what it was. And that's where most of us will start, or many of us will start, is not exactly knowing what our genius is. And that's, I appreciate the name of your program, Everyday Genius, because it is an everyday process. Because what you need to do if you really want to invite your genius is begin with commitment, a very simple one. I commit to bringing forth more of my genius every day. I always say every important commitment in life can be made in 10 seconds or one breath. I commit to bringing forth my genius every day of my life. It's a powerful general commitment to start with, but if you're sincere about it, I always tell my people in our seminars that the longest journey they will ever make, but the most important journey, is only 12 inches from their head to their heart.
Yeah.
But we need to take what's up here and get it down here in order for it to really make a difference. That's why my wife and I were pioneers in the fields of body-centered transformation, because we realized early on that people could talk about their problems for 10 years and never got anything done. And so we needed to find a way to get a whole body involvement with people. And that's why we were participants in the revolution called body-centered transformation.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think this is one of the things when I work with businesses and helping them to kind of communicate their message better, is if you can help them kind of drop that message down in from the intellect, you know, into the heart and connect the two together, you know, then all of a sudden the message that you're putting across comes from a different place, and it comes with a vibration, and people feel that rather than just hearing the words, they feel something, and then that connection is so much stronger.
Yes, and I can testify that it works wonders. Mm-hmm. That when you connect with that inner genius of yourself, once you do that, once you make that 12-inch journey down into here and say, okay, what truly is my genius? Then you're on a wavelength, you're on a moonbeam, you're on some sort of a wave of energy.
Yeah.
It's like that beautiful Kathleen Raine's poem about the invisible way, that about how birds follow an invisible way across the sky.
Yeah.
They're sensitive to something that is going on that they're making slight adjustments to. That's actually one of the things we talk most about in conscious luck, is to think of luck as a wind that's always blowing. And we show you ways in the book of adjusting your sails so that you catch the winds properly and it becomes effortless. Mm-hmm. I remember one time when my little girl, when my daughter was a little girl, she's now a 6-footer, but she was about maybe 8 years old at the time. And she was astonishingly lucky in the sense that she was always finding money on the ground. I mean, I'd be walking along. I remember one day in particular, I was walking along with her in Marin County, California, and I saw her drop behind and then catch up, and she held up a $10 bill, you know, and this was a long time ago. $10 bill is, you know, a big deal for a kid. But she was always doing things like that. And I asked her one time, what do you think makes you so lucky? And she says, I'm not lucky, Dad. I just pay attention. Boy, wisdom coming out of the mouths of youths, you know. Yeah. That was a really profound little thing she said, because, I mean, can you think of anything that's more true than that? I mean, if you pay attention, you get these little opportunities. Mm-hmm. I tell a lot of stories about that in conscious luck, but the basic idea is once you get on that wavelength, you're more likely to be at the right place at the right time for good things to happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting. I recently turned 75, and it was a marker to me because it was 25 years since I decided to stop working for money. I was lucky. I made plenty of money by the time I was 50, so I didn't really need to do anything more that I didn't want to do, basically. And so I made this choice to spend, I was spending at the time about 30% or so of my time in my genius spiral.
Yeah.
But I was still doing a lot of stuff that I didn't want to do, you know, like a consulting job I agreed to do because the money was great, but I didn't really like the people, but I needed to make a down payment on our building. You know, life, you know, kind of gets to you sometimes. And so you make these decisions where I think the cells of our body are saying, No. And we're going, yes. And so we kind of get this growing gulf between here and here, and it makes a big difference in our lives. And so I think the second half of life, oftentimes, you know, when you get up to be 35, 40 years old, becomes about growing a different personality than what got you to 35 or 40.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of that is perhaps intent. You know, when we start out in life, you know, we don't think about, we're kind of like carried along by, you know, what we see around us, by the influences, you know, of our parents, by the influences of our peers, and we just get carried along. And then I think that there comes a point where you start to realize actually you have choice, you have choices, and if you then make those choices with with intent, then things start to change. And I think it's about, you know, the results you get are to a large degree, not always, but to a large degree based on, you know, the intent that you put out there. And if you put out good intent, then the results amplify. If you're doing things with the wrong intent, then you, there are instances where people that are have the wrong intent are extremely successful and rise to levels of extreme power. But, you know, in most cases, those people suffer in some way, shape or form. They may not suffer outwardly, but they perhaps suffer inwardly.
Yeah, you can tell when you look at a lot of politicians, hint, hint, that they're not happy and they're not having a good time at home. And, you know, it radiates from their body. And I feel compassion about that. And it also gets us in a lot of trouble, those kinds of activities. I forgot to tag the end of my thought there when I was talking about when I kind of retired at age 50 from doing anything I didn't want to do. I went from about 30% to up to 90%, which is basically where I still am today. There's still a certain amount of time I'm doing things that I'm not exactly a genius at, like cleaning out the kitty litter or taking the trash out or talking to a gardener or something like that. So I leave 10% there that I'm not going to mess with, but I feel like I'm using all of my time now especially for the last 20 or 25 years in really doing what I most love to do.
Yeah.
And that's why I feel as excited about it today as I did 25 or 30 years ago when these ideas first started to become important to me.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. When did you start to, you kind of identify this as genius now, but you know, was there a point when you realized that was genius, or you know, what led up to you actually realizing that what's different between one thought process and your genius, or one way of doing things, and actually this idea that it's now genius?
Yes. Well, for me, it took a little period, like about an hour of wondering my way into it. And I'll tell you exactly what happened. I was in Colorado Springs, where I was a university professor at the graduate school there for many years, 21 years. And I taught people how to be counselors and therapists and that sort of thing. But I was really disenchanted with being a university professor. It's all I ever wanted to be when I was growing up. And I got it when I was 28 or 29, something like that. But by the time I was 40, I was realizing, gosh, I'm spending all my time going to committee meetings and doing paperwork and going to Boulder to be at conferences and stuff that, you know, all this stuff takes over your life. And so you end up not being able to do as much working directly with students or, you know, counseling real people as you would like. And so I was getting so disenchanted with that. And one day I was being shown around different houses by a realtor in 1977, I remember it was, and I was considering changing houses. And this realtor had something on the radio, and I still don't remember who this was or have any idea who it was, but it was some sort of a motivational speaker in 1977. And this speaker was saying that most human misery comes from the lack of a worthwhile goal. Mm-hmm. And it was just this little snippet I heard on the radio. And it got me thinking, though, wow, what is my real goal in life? What am I really doing here? And so after I got through with the realtor, I went back to my apartment and I sat down on the floor, actually, and I just decided that I would wonder about that and try to figure out what it was that I was really doing here. And I think it took me about an hour of kind of wondering my way into it. And I always in those days I would sketch out things on a yellow pad with my Bic pen, what I think you guys call a biro.
Yeah.
But it's the ones that over here sell for 29 cents a piece last forever and get blue ink all over you. So that was my pen of choice. And so to this day, I still get out my yellow pad and my Bic if I really want to do some serious thinking. So I was kind of sketching it out. And as I did, I realized the only thing I really love to do is be with groups of people where we're considering the most important things in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's all I'm really good at. That's all that really turns me on in the workday world.
Yeah.
And so I said, gosh, if a guy like me fails to do my genius, what kind of example is that going to set? And so I wrote out this sentence, which I really haven't changed much to this day. It is, I expand every day in love, creativity, and abundance as I inspire others to do the same. Mm-hmm. So that takes care of every moment of my life.
Yeah.
Because if I'm not actually inspiring others, which I presume I'm doing at this moment, that's what I'm intending anyway, then I'm thinking about it, thinking about, you know, I've got a stack of interviews all day today. I'm in the midst of launching a new book. So I'm kind of living on Skype and yeah. Zoom and things like that. I'm particularly enjoying my UK conversations because they take place early in the morning, which is kind of when I'm at my zestiest, I would say, all day. And so once I kind of get into the day, I find that things like still having to sign my name to things and push papers around still has a little tiresome quality to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. For sure. So how, you know, if there's someone listening and they're thinking, well, how do I get to you know, my genius? What are the steps? You know, what would be the things that you would recommend they can do to try and just tap into it and even get a glimpse of what that thing is? You know, you talk about in The Joy of Genius, you talk about like the genius moment, the genius move, and then moving into the genius spiral, which you referenced earlier, and you're now kind of living in that 90%, which is incredible, and I strive to get to that percentage at some point.
Well, do you feel like you're doing your genius this moment as we're having this conversation?
You know what's funny? Since we relaunched the Simply Conscious project, every day has felt exactly like that. Yeah, things are, there's just, I gave this analogy to, my business partner and I were talking, and I just said, it just feels like at the moment, we've walked through a door, and every single door in the corridor has swung open. Mm-hmm. And not swung open to the fact that, you know, there's suddenly this rush to go through because they're going to shut any moment, but they've flung open and they're open and we can just wander in and out and explore each one and see where things take us. It just seems that things are expanding. It's you mentioned in The Big Leap, you talk about Einstein time. It feels like we're surfing at the moment. You know, it really does feel like we are in our zone of genius.
Oh, I really so salute you for that, because so few people make that bold choice. But here's, you know, luck feeds off genius.
Yeah.
You know, because it becomes, you move through the world effortlessly. It's like an automatic door spots you and opens up for you 20 feet away. And so you're having that experience. And that, you know, interestingly enough, that was one of my first literal experiences as I begin to tap into this. Not long after I sat down and I kind of dedicated myself to that principle of I expand in love, abundance, and creativity every day as I inspire others to do the same, I got the opportunity to teach on cable TV in Colorado, which was really nice because they kind of said, it's developmental psychology, it's a course on developmental psychology, but you can kind of flavor it any way you want with personal stories from people or lectures or however you want to do it. And so they kind of gave me an open playbook. And that was a salute to my new purpose in life, because suddenly, you know, I was reaching more people with that than 40. They had it live on a classroom that had about 40 people in it. So I was doing it live for 40 people, but I didn't know how many thousands were watching it at home. So that really fit my purpose. And so there was the beginning of a number of kind of magical things that were like those doors opening. And I believe once you get on that invisible way, that invisible path that Kathleen Rains is talking about, once you open your sails to luck, good things tend to happen. And it's so easy because it begins with something you can do in 10 seconds that doesn't cost you a shilling. And so it's simply, as I point out in Joy of Genius, catching yourself in the middle of thinking about something you don't have any control over, like what somebody thinks about you or what happened yesterday. Those things you have absolutely no control over, but they occupy a tremendous amount of our time. So catch yourself in doing that and then let go of control. Take a free breath. Let go of trying to control something that you don't have any control over anyway.
Yeah.
It's a great cosmic joke, although it's not so funny when we're caught up in the middle of it. And so I think that one of the most important things any human being can do is get good at unplugging themselves from trying to control things they have no control over. Mm-hmm. And so I will say that cheerfully as long as I have breath to say it with, because it directly leads to genius. See, because in that open space, when you're letting go of control, that's when your genius can come forth, because you already know what your genius is. Mm-hmm. I already knew it down inside. It took me an hour to kind of open up and own it and get it worded right. But right from the beginning, I could realize, oh, I had this feeling of what I most love to do. And that's a key to it, Pete. Mm. A key to it is to focus in on what you most love to do.
Yeah.
Because as you ask yourself that question, when you do what we call around here a wonder question, when you genuinely, what do I most love to do? Sometimes people know just like this. Boing. Some people, it takes a while to wonder their way into it. Like I said, it took me about an hour. But what do I most love to do? Well, what I'm doing right now is what I most love to do. And when I'm with my wife, as I will be shortly for breakfast, that's what I most love to do. And so what I advocate people doing is surround themselves with as much things that feed love into them and you feed love into as you possibly can. The way I put it is get yourself 3 to 5 people in your life whose eyes light up when you walk in the room. Get yourself 3 to 5 people who make your eyes light up when you walk in the room and see them. Surround yourself with people that feed you steadily on the most essential things in life. So put a priority on that. And you'll notice that other things in the workaday world go much better. Yep. I'm working with a well-known attorney in Hollywood right now who works with a lot of people that you'd recognize from the movies and that kind of thing. And so, but this is exactly the kind of thing I'm working with him on. See, I'm trying to think, I've had at least 100, maybe less, maybe more, attorneys and doctors, medical doctors, come in to me over the years for counseling with the following story. They're all about 40 to 45 years old, and they say the following thing in one way or the other. They say, I'm at the top of my game. I'm making my $500,000 a year, and my wife and kids love flying first class, and they love our condo in Hawaii, and yet I feel like if I keep going like this, I'm going to kill myself.
Yeah.
And so that's why I say at midlife, you need to grow another personality that's not the one that got you to 40. And so when you're, when I start working with those folks on, I would say other than about 3 or 4 that I can think of, all of them have been males. So it's kind of a male affliction in a way of a high achievement, high powered society. You want to get to the top of the heap at the earliest possible time, if you're especially if you're an attorney or in one of those more competitive fields, and you want to do as much as you can in the time you have, and so you tend to be very accelerated in lots of aspects of life. Mm-hmm. I was reading a study a while back that 60% of a doctor's first words out of his mouth when he comes in the door and meets the patient is not, hello, Mrs. McGruder. It's, I'm sorry, I'm late.
Mm.
I apologize for being late. That's the lead piece in 60% of the conversation. So, and it's true across all the different professions of the world. I'm not picking on medicine, but we have an opportunity at midlife, particularly. It starts kind of sniffing at our door in the 30s and starts pounding on our door when we're around 40, 42 years old. When I used to teach developmental psychology on television, I taught it in decades. So the decade of the 30s is a lot about coming home to yourself, forming a business that represents your genius, and finding your lucky tribe of genius seekers that are willing to get in the room with you and do the sweaty conversations that it takes to produce genius in the world. Yeah. I've consulted, I don't do it anymore now, but I used to consult a lot for businesses and particularly with executive teams of corporations back in the 90s. And I was privileged to consult with and coach Michael Dell and his top three people back during the 90s. And I learned a lot from working with amazing human beings like him and other people, whether or not they were billionaires. He happens to be one of the few actual billionaires I've worked with, but he was a stunning example of one. But what makes them so unique among all of these professionals, business people I've consulted with, is that the higher they go, the more open to learning they get. You know, like I can remember conversations with Michael where I presented a somewhat radical idea to him on a personal level, not so much on the business level. He's so far 500 times beyond me in business that I wouldn't even attempt to do that. But I would make suggestions to him that ran counter to things he'd been thinking about. But he never got defensive at all. He was remarkable. I mean, I can think of 100 others like him who did get defensive when I brought up something they didn't necessarily want to hear. But that's the therapist's job, you know. If you're not, those are the moments you get paid for. If not, you should just soak up the change that people go through. But it's those moments where people mount a resistance to change that where you really have to kind of navigate your way through. And so, the point I'm making is that the openness to learning factor is so important in life, to make that little adjustment in yourself, to become more open to learning and less defensive. That's a key thing, especially in your 30s. And then when you move into your 40s, there's a whole different set of things that happen. And it becomes more important as you get into your 40s to really discover what your true life purpose is. We say in developmental psychology, excuse me, I need to take a quick swallow. Had my last half ounce of coffee there. In developmental psychology, we say in your 30s, you find your life. In your 40s, you build your life. And in your 50s, you enjoy your life. Now, I want you to enjoy it now, wherever you are. Don't wait till your 50s. But there is a tendency in people to be very concerned with integration in their 30s.
Yeah.
By the way, how old are you?
49.
Oh, 49. Okay. So I bet you remember this from your 30s. That there was a tremendous, you got lots and lots of cues to come home to yourself. And you didn't pay attention to all of them.
No.
Nor did I. You know, and I always say that the universe is happy to teach us with the feather tickle. But if we don't pay attention to the tickle of the feather, it's also totally happy to teach us with a sledgehammer. It doesn't care.
Yeah.
It just needs to get the message across. And so the quality of the incoming is always equal to the openness to it from here. So from inside, our openness depends on, I mean, it makes the quality of our learning more refined or subtle or loud and noisy. I've done both. I've paid attention, believe it or not. I'm, as I sit here, I'm a 6 foot tall, 180 pounder. I can't remember what that is in stone, but 180 pounds of avoirdupois. And yet at one point in my life, up until I was 24 years old, I'd suffered from childhood obesity all the way through my teenage years. And by the time I was 24 years old, I weighed 320 pounds, which is 140 pounds more than I have weighed ever since then. And I had this big wake-up moment where I think for the first time in my life, I felt whole. And I not only weighed 320 pounds, but I was in this awful relationship at the time. And I was smoking heavily, 2 to 3 packs of cigarettes a day. Didn't like my job very much, was eager to go back to graduate school and learn counseling, but I was still too stuck in where I was. I had a slip and fall out on the ice one day. I mean, as I walked out of my house, I slipped on a place on the ice that was covered up by snow. and I went whoomp down on my back. I didn't knock myself out, but I now call it having an out of Hendrix experience because I kind of knocked myself out of my normal way of being for 2 minutes. And during that 2 minutes, I had something brand new happen. It wasn't like I was out of my body. It was like I was the other direction. I was in my body. And I could feel things that I'd never felt before. I felt a lot of grief still in my chest, and I felt a lot of anger in my jaws, the way they were set and the furrow of my brow. I felt a lot of fear down in my belly that I'd never known about before. And it was like a light went off in the room called feelings for the first time. A light went on in there and illuminated all the stuff that I'd never really paid attention to. And that was important because I realized that a lot of my 320 pounds of fat was protecting me against those feelings. It was sealing off those feelings under this layer of extraneous stuff. And that I'd certainly never talked about any of that before, the things I was sad about or the things about my father dying. My father died before I was born when my mother was pregnant with me at the end of the Second World War. And so I never had a father, and I, you know, could feel the sadness of that, but I'd never really contacted it before or told anybody about it. Well, I made this commitment as I was coming out of this 2 minute experience. I could feel my old persona establishing itself again. I could feel the urge to light up a cigarette, and I realized I still weighed 300 pounds. And so I was back in my Hendrix experience again. And interestingly enough, I met Jimi Hendrix once, just wanted to mention that, and in a whole other context. Yeah. And so there I was lying on the ground, and I made this commitment before I got up, and it saved my life, I think. I made a commitment to feeling that open, spacious feeling all the time. Oh, that was the other thing I didn't mention, that underneath all of my feelings, I could realize that there was this kind of a vast ocean space of pure consciousness that didn't really have any programming on it. It didn't have any of my history on it. It was just there. And if the guy next door had the same experience, he would have a different set of programming, but he would have that pure consciousness too. I realized it was our birthright. That was a big moment for me. And I made a commitment to living in that all the time before I got up off the ground. So commitment again saved the day, because within a year, I lost more than 100 pounds. I gave up the cigarette thing, which was hellaciously hard, and got out of that relationship, and it was like everything in my life turned over. And as luck would have it, I went down to the University of New Hampshire, 20 minutes away, one night to take an English class. I decided to get back into graduate school and take an English class because I'd been an English major. And I got so bored in the English class that I left early and went looking for the guy I'd had a ride over there with who was taking a counseling class. And so I stuck my head in the door, and there was about 50 people in the class, and they were all sitting around in little clumps of six or eight people, little groups. And it turned out that the class was all about kind of like little counseling groups that was all oriented that way. And so I stuck my head in, and I waved to Neil, and I said, you know, I'm going to be in the car waiting. And he said, no, come on in. And so he waved me in, and I sat down in his group. And that rearranged my brain cells completely, because what they were doing were just going around the group talking about what had gone on in their lives that week.
Yeah.
Totally stunning. And so that's how my entry into counseling went. By the end of that time, I was hooked.
Beautiful. How does, do you see a lot of this, or what are your thoughts on, because you mentioned a lot about feelings. There, you know, and one thing I notice is that, you know, generationally, you know, there's a, especially within men, there's a resistance, there's an inbuilt kind of program that says we don't show our emotions, we don't talk about our emotions, we don't show any weakness. Is that something you see a lot of, and are you seeing that like changing now? Because I mean, certainly I see a softening. Yeah, not only within younger generations, but also within my circle of friends, in so much as maybe this is me attracting those people as well, is that there's actually much more openness and much more willingness to to go deep and to really feel.
Oh, I think so, definitely. Well, I can tell you for one thing, when we started teaching relationship seminars, which was now almost 40 years ago, my wife and I have been together 40 years, we had 3/4 to 2/3 of the participants were always women. And, you know, it was always something we discussed too, because you can't put in a relationship seminar 2/3 to 1/3 and not talk about that subject. So, so people didn't have to be couples. They came as singles too, but a lot of them were single women or married women that were just looking for something different in their lives. And, but now guess what? 40 years later, it's almost 50-50.
Wow. Nice.
That, and sometimes it's more men than women. Last year at our Berkeley course, there were more male couples there. This happened to be a couples course. There were more male couples there than were women couples. Wow. Or heterosexual couples.
Yeah.
And so it was really a beautiful thing to see. So anyway, to make a long story short, if you think you got problems at 30 or 49, I grew up in the John Wayne era, you know, where men didn't talk about their feelings at all. You know, the strong, silent type was the way that to be. As a matter of fact, I remember my brother giving me direct counseling on that subject when I was a little kid. I went out and I got into the baseball game that the bigger kids were in out in the field across from my house. And I was playing shortstop and I took a shot, a grounder right in the eye. I went down for a grounder and it took a bad hop and whacked me right in the eye, right above the eye, and hit me so hard it left the imprint of the baseball in my forehead for a little while. But I went down, but when I got up, I was crying. And I remember my brother pulling me off the field to take me back to the house, saying, "Man, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry around here, man." And it was like, in this neighborhood, if you exhibit weakness, it's all over for you. That was his message, basically. And so that can be true even if you grew up in a middle class neighborhood.
Yeah, absolutely. And does that, in your experience as well, is that an inhibitor to finding your genius as well, the suppression of emotions and feelings?
It certainly is, because think of human beings as, see, early in our life, we're kind of programmed to put certain feelings in one, trained to think that certain feelings come out of one faucet, the bad feelings, and the good feelings come out of the good faucet. And we're supposed to keep the bad feeling faucet turned down and keep the full, you see what I'm getting? We think there are two faucets. That's what we're programmed to believe. But life is really only has one faucet, and it's marked awareness. And as you open the faucet of awareness, open your doors of perception to more and more awareness, what happens is you move through all of those fields to find this field of pure consciousness that I'm talking about, which holds both good and bad, right and wrong, up and down. It's the container for all of that. And once you can get yourself identified so you feel that on a daily basis, that takes a lot of the pressure off of trying to keep those faucets adjusted up there. And so as soon as possible, realize, okay, I'm not too flows. I'm one flow, and my job is to open to as much of the flow as I can, to sort through all the bad stuff and open up to all the good stuff and find that place that holds both of them. Our great poet Walt Whitman has a verse that says, "I am large and contain multitudes." And so this place I'm talking about of open spaciousness is a place that holds all of your different personas and aspects of yourself.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. And it's funny because that reminds me, you know, with Simply Conscious, we've just started or invited or been invited again. This is one of those things, magic things that just came out of what we're doing. And we connected with six amazing young adults from 7 years old to 19 years old. and just suddenly felt a calling to look at how we could create something that allowed them to share their message, that allowed them to teach and share with the next generation. And out of that has now been born this project called Simply Conscious Next Generation. And the way we've kind of described or talked about this is actually we're not here as the adults to teach. All we're here to do is to provide a container, a safe space for them just to then express their own characteristics, their own personalities, and explore, you know, who they are, and then deliver their own genius in this safe container. So yeah, it kind of just felt that what you were saying was very similar, yeah, to what we've just experienced, yeah, happening with the emergence of this new project.
Yes, well, it sounds, what I've found in life is that oftentimes if you're getting closer to your own genius, the closer you get to your own genius, the more you find it's very similar to things that other people are doing with their genius. Because I think genius calls forth different capabilities at different times in evolution, as well as different times in our own personal evolution, that your genius begins to really knock on the door at midlife. You know, it begins to knock on your door at 40 or 42. And of course, it's banging on your door when you're getting up around, yeah, 50. Here we say in our seminars, we say that every breath you take after 50 is a breath of stagnation or a breath of creativity. Wow. That your 50s and on into your 60s are those decades where you really need to open up to your genius to fully get your creativity online, because very quickly people go into stagnation when they don't breathe with their genius every day.
Mm. Wow, that's beautiful. And yeah, I'll definitely be reminding myself of that on a daily basis. So thank you for sharing that. I want to kind of give you an opportunity just to talk a little bit about kind of conscious luck, and I want to understand kind of where that's come from, and you know, what's, you know, the transition. I'm always interested in the transition, you know, from the big leap to the joy of genius to, you know, to conscious luck. So
yes, well, after the Big Leap came out, I always, the way my writing career has gone, I learn something, figure it out how it works, and then I write a book about it. Mm-hmm. And so I did that with The Big Leap. I put 35 years, I say it took me 35 years to write it, because I was thinking about it for 35 years beforehand, and I finally could get it into words when I did 10 years ago. But so I felt like I'd summarized this body of work up until then. And then I was, as I worked with other people, I began to see how every single one of them, even though they had worked hard and done really cool things, also thought of themselves as very lucky. If I ever asked them, do you feel like you're a lucky person? They would say, yeah, you know, and they would rattle off about 16 different things that had happened in their life that they wouldn't be there unless, you know, and so I have some of those too. And so it became really, luck began to be more and more of a factor for me as I began to say, what's the one thing that contributes to success that I haven't really explored? And so I began to explore the relationship between luck and success and what people did that made them lucky. And so that concluded in conscious luck.
Yeah.
That's it's probably going to be the last nonfiction book I write. I feel like I'm very up to date with things as far as expressing everything I really needed to express. And so I write mystery novels in my spare time. As a matter of fact, my latest mystery series is a Londoner, Sir Errol Hyde. And he is practicing as a kind of a semi-aristocratic private detective in 1908, 1910, 1912. He's a cross-town competitor of Sherlock Holmes, and but a very ironic, humorous one. And so I'd be delighted to put a Sir Errol book. I've published three so far, and I've got a couple more that I'm working on now. So he's my current fascination. It gives me a chance to write and florid Victorian prose, which is an old English major, delights me. I get to use words like codswallop and things like that that have gone out of fashion. So that's, but for my last book, as was the others, they usually summarize a period of thinking. Mm. And so this summarizes my thoughts on what you need to do to get your sails adjusted so that you're happening in the luck-a-day world.
Ah, beautiful, beautiful. And I'm guessing, yeah, a lot of that still comes back to awareness, yeah, because there is, yeah, there's infinite possibilities around us at any one time. More often than we're close to them, aren't we? So what one person perceives as luck, you know, someone else has perhaps worked hard to position themselves to receive that luck.
Exactly. You always get the amount of luck you're open to. If you get a lightning strike bolt of luck, you know, there's a lot of research on lottery winners and what happens to lottery winners in the year or two after they get a big check. Well, it's not a pretty sight. I did a lot of that research myself. And you know, it's almost like 50 or 60% of the time people end up sometimes worse off than they were before through a whole bunch of negative things that happened to them. And that's what happens if a fundamentally unlucky feeling person gets a lightning strike and happens to be standing in the right line at the right time to bite the right lottery ticket. You know, things can happen, but watch out afterwards. So if you do what we're talking about in the book, practice those eight things, or even one of those eight things, eight tools we give, things will happen that are unexplainable to you. And we have a Facebook page that's dedicated to people's conscious luck stories, what happened after they started opening up their sails to luck. And some of the stories, I've seen a bunch of them, gosh, they're really quite amazing. Things that I would have never thought of in a million years, even though I'm a mystery novelist, I would never have thought of these unusual events. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Absolutely, yes. Thank you so much for spending the time with us. You know, I appreciate you jumping on early. And thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I'm looking forward to getting my copy of Conscious Luck.
Well, good. I hope it finds its way to you soon, and may it lead to many, many more lucky moments. It sounds like you've made decisions that are in the favor of your genius, in favor of your genius. And I salute that and approve of that and appreciate that. It's a gift to the world as well as to yourself.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye now.
We are Sarva. The future of education starts here.